It is not a budget that the Congress is going to enact.
President Trump's budget outline is public, but that doesn't mean it's getting the full support of Capitol Hill Republicans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the State House sets a time limit for debate on the budget, but a big showdown still looms with the Senate.
They are stifling our opportunities, and now they're doing it again on the floor.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
The White House today released an outline of President Trump's first budget. As expected, the document calls for cutting government programs to offset a big increase in defense spending. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin looks at what the budget would mean for Alaska if Congress chooses to adopt it.
The first thing Senator Lisa Murkowski wants you to know about Trump's budget is that Congress is not going to adopt it.
This is the president's request. It is not a budget that the Congress is going to enact.
That's the case every year. The Constitution gives Congress the national purse strings. Murkowski says she's been reminding her staff of that because alarmed Alaskans are already calling her office.
And there is plenty in this budget request to get very upset about because these are priorities that for us in a high-cost, cold, remote state mean a lot.
The budget would eliminate essential air service and LIHEAP, low-income home energy assistance, two programs that send millions of dollars to Alaska each year. It would stop funding for the Denali Commission for Rural Infrastructure. Trump's budget would also defund an EPA program that last year provided $20 million to build water and wastewater projects in Alaska Native villages, where thousands of homes still lack running water and residents have to haul their waste in buckets. And yet the budget also says the president is providing robust funding for critical water infrastructure. Murkowski says an Alaska village can't compete with places like Flint, Michigan in federal programs because an agency is likely to apply a simple cost-benefit analysis.
When you do that, Alaska always loses because our costs are high and the numbers of people that you're serving are low.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt met with Murkowski before his confirmation vote. She says he understands the need to fund Alaska Village water projects because he raised the issue with her.
So we're going to keep him to his word on that. Too important.
Murkowski serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee, and she chairs the subcommittee that writes the EPA budget. She points out that the cabinet secretaries are still assembling their teams. She says this budget may have been written by people who aren't familiar with all the programs.
And if you don't know exactly what they do and how helpful or beneficial they are, it might be really easy to say, well, we'll just get rid of that one. We'll just take that one off the books. We'll zero it out for now until somebody says otherwise. And my sense is that that's some of what we're dealing with right now.
Murkowski is also reminding her staff that the 53-page document the White House released isn't even the president's real budget. The fuller version is expected in late April. Of the things she likes, Murkowski named the increase in spending to restore military forces, which she says may mean the 425 Brigade Combat Team at J-Bear will be kept whole. Senator Dan Sullivan, in a written statement, praised the increase in defense spending, but said some of the budget cuts fall too heavily on rural communities. Alaska Congressman Don Young issued a statement, too, and he put it bluntly. This budget isn't going anywhere. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Alaska House voted to shut down discussion on the state budget. Members of the House minority say the action is stifling debate. The two House caucuses disagree about the budget, the rules, and what lawmakers should focus on. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The House floor session on Thursday was the culmination of weeks of frustration on both sides of the aisle. Members of the mostly Democratic majority say they've allowed more amendments to the budget than in any session that any current House member has seen. But Republican minority caucus members say they've never seen a majority limit the number of amendments or the budget debate. House Minority Leader Anchorage Republican Charisse Millett says Speaker Bryce Edgman unfairly limited debate.
They are stifling our opportunities, and now they're doing it again on the floor. I mean, it's a shame that Speaker Edgman feels that he has to do this. It's unfortunate because I think he's a reasonable guy up until today. I mean, I've never seen a speaker do this before.
Some of the conflict may be the result of the change in partisan control of the House. Edgman is the first Democratic speaker since 1993. Edgman says the majority acted to limit debate when it appeared the minority would extend debate for days at a time when the House faces other pressing issues.
It's also debate that follows on the heel of a very robust subcommittee process as well as a finance committee process that found, at least in my memory, a record amount of budget amendments to be offered. And all this in the midst of Alaska being in a fiscal crisis.
The first 40 minority amendments would have cut about $50 million from the $4.3 billion state budget. The majority rejected all of the cuts. Republican minority members say there's nothing more pressing than to make more cuts before considering actions like making changes to the permanent fund. Former Speaker Nikiski Republican Mike Chenault says he would hold budget debates until late into the night. The sessions were frequently interrupted for breaks this week and ended by 9 p.m. each day.
Not once have we ever limited debate to the minority on amendments. And that is exactly what we're doing here today.
House Rules Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux made the motion to end debate at noon on Friday. It passed along caucus lines, 22-18. She says it was apparent that the minority was engaging in a filibuster, which is a term for making speeches to prevent action.
So we just decided basically that enough was enough.
Friday will be the fifth day of debate on budget amendments. There were more than 50 amendments debated through Thursday afternoon. Majority members say the legislature should complete work on the budget and move on to bills that would draw money from the permanent fund. The majority has also introduced bills that would reinstate an income tax and reduce oil and gas tax credits. The state has a nearly $3 billion gap between the amount the state spends and the amount it raises in oil royalties, taxes, and fees. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Three federal judges are asking Congress not to break up the vast San Francisco-based Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, a longtime target of Republicans and a recent foe of President Donald Trump. The Ninth Circuit in February refused to immediately reinstate Trump's ban on travelers from seven predominantly Muslim nations, prompting the administration to release a new, narrower ban. On Wednesday, Trump renewed his criticism of the court, saying at a Nashville event that, quote, people are screaming to break up the Ninth, which encompasses nine western states, including Alaska. The Ninth Circuit covers the largest area and population of any federal appeals court. Republican Representative Daryl Issa of California led a hearing on the issue today. Three judges from the Ninth Circuit testified and all asked Congress to leave the court alone. The circuit has 29 judges. The next largest is the Fifth Circuit with 17 judges. The state Senate today passed a bill that leaves in place an order to provide naloxone, an anti-overdose drug, to Alaskan organizations and individuals for another 4 years. Governor Bill Walker had issued a 30-day emergency disaster declaration in February to make naloxone widely available. Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Jay Butler, says today's legislative action keeps the order in place.
Well, the bill that was passed by the Senate today establishes the authority to continue the standing orders for distribution of naloxone, the drug that reverses the effects of an opioid overdose, into the year 2021. So if that's done in statute, apart from the disaster declaration, we can let the 30-day lifespan of the declaration lapse, and what we can continue the project surrounding distribution of the Project Hope kits, the opioid overdose rescue kits.
And please describe for us what's meant by a standing order.
Well, the standing order is basically a prescription that can be applied statewide so that each individual person that receives a rescue kit does not need an individual prescription. So the kit is received under the prescribing authority of my medical license so that it can be more readily available during an emergency situation.
Dr. Butler, since the declaration that the governor signed and sent out in February, in that window of time, what have you seen as far as people asking for naloxone across the state? What's the response been?
Well, the response has been huge. And in the first month under the disaster declaration, we distributed over 1,200 of the kits. We get a lot of requests for the kits from various people and organizations among faith-based organizations, in the recovery community, and increasing number of smaller towns that may not have the medical direction needed to be able to make the kits more widely available.
Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Southeast Alaska couple aims to make Alaska kelp a commercial food.
Kelp salsa. It's made from predominantly bull kelp that we harvest from around Juneau.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A lack of bus drivers in the Fairbanks area is making some students late to class. According to the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District, as many as 16 bus routes do not have a driver on any given day in the district. District officials have been coping with the shortage by combining some of the 128 bus routes currently in operation. A spokesman for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District's transportation contractor, First Student, says the bus driver shortage is a nationwide issue that they are trying to deal with. The Ohio-based contractor said it is training new drivers and flying in drivers from Juneau to help get students to school after spring break. About 7,000 students in Fairbanks and North Pole ride the bus daily. Transition to a new booking system will up the cost of renting popular Alaska State Parks public use cabins. Acting State Parks Director Matt Wedeking says a flat $8 reservation fee will be added to the rental cost for 66 cabins statewide. Wedeking says the fee is the result of State Parks switching from an in-house reservation system to nationwide vendor Reserve America.
That is new. That will be a fee to the customer on the Reserve America system.
Wedeking says there will also be new fees for changing or canceling reservations.
There's a fee charged to the customer to cancel a reservation of $5, and to modify a reservation, it's going to cost you $3. But with the system, you'll be able to, it's a lot more user-friendly to do that.
Wedeking says users currently have to call to alter a reservation and are issued cabin credits for cancellations. State Parks will not be taking any reservations between March 20th and April 1st as it transitions to the new system. And anyone who cancels during that time or has an unused cabin credit will be issued a refund. Reserve America already handles reservations for state parks in 31 other states, as well as for U.S. Forest and Fish and Wildlife Services. Wedeking says the system, which includes a mobile AP, offers new options and opportunities.
We can actually send out a notification like, hey, Byers Lake Cabin is not booked during these weekdays. Are you interested? So it's more like a constant contact sort of back and forth.
Wedeking says being able to better track cabin usage and more easily contact users also opens the possibility of offering discounted rates on open cabins.
To see if we can fill it. So there's an opportunity there to get more bookings for us, which increases our revenue and providing a better deal for the public.
He says state parks expect the new system to overall reduce management costs. The state anticipates transitioning other recreational facilities like campgrounds to the Reserve America system later this year. The state of Alaska is receiving more than $8 million in settlement money after a top car company cheated on its federal emissions tests. Volkswagen sold more than 500,000 diesel-powered cars nationwide between 2009 and 2016. But those cars were equipped with so-called defeat devices, or software that masked actual emissions when tested. The governor's office has appointed the Alaska Energy Authority to help administer the state's share of the settlement. Sean Scaling is an energy policy director at AEA.
This is just another way to leverage some of that improvement that's really needed in rural Alaska.
Scaling says the types of projects that can be funded are defined in the settlement. It includes improving emissions for transit buses, ferries, and boats. That could mean replacing diesel engines with fully electric or hybrid ones. Additionally, the money can also be used to upgrade energy infrastructure in remote villages. The agency is taking public comments to help prioritize the most effective projects, and the final plan is expected to be completed in the fall. Scaling says this $8 million is different from the Volkswagen buyback program and settlement money that's being doled out nationwide. Outside of what the state is receiving, the settlement includes nearly $54 million for federally recognized tribes.
One role that AEA can play here is we can help bring together whole regions, tribes within regions, for example, to leverage other funding and to make the most of the funding that is available.
The U.S. Department of Justice will be administering the tribal allocation. Scaling expects the deadline to submit a plan for that will be September 1st.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Seventy-five years ago, the Navy built a marine railway in Unalaska. It was basically an underwater railroad that helped the military haul boats out of the Bering Sea during World War II. Since then, the railway has slowly gone to seed. But KUCB's Laura Craigle got a history lesson before it was demolished for good.
Next to Unalaska's small boat harbor, in the shadow of Bunker Hill, construction crews are tearing down a piece of history.
So what they're doing is they just now are loading up the steel carriage, I guess is what you call it, that they used to pull the boats and the subs up in.
Joe Sacramento is the property manager for Pacific Stevedoring, the shipping company that took over the railway site a year and a half ago. He's standing next to a giant mechanical carriage that was the crux of this whole operation back in 1942.
That was the bottom that sat on these rails, and they would block it up with wood blocks and just pull it straight up and out.
If you're not a mariner, the procedure's kind of hard to picture, but it went something like this. Navy men would drive a boat into the harbor, where ghostly train tracks still emerge from the water, continue up the bank, and run straight through an open space in the hollowed-out railway building. They'd pull up on the tracks and fit blocks around the boat's hull. That way, it wouldn't tip, as they used the carriage to reel it out of the water and into the workshop area, where welders and carpenters were waiting.
They could take a boat as big as a minesweeper, which was a wooden-hulled boat, less than 100 feet long.
That's Jeff Dickrell, a local historian who spent his career studying the Aleutian Islands and their role in the Second World War. He says when the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in June of 1942, the island's military base was still pretty small. But more than 50 people died during the two-day attack, and it became clear the Aleutians were vulnerable. So, the military got to work. Navy construction battalions expanded the base. The battalion members were called Seabees, and Dickrell says they built the Marine Railway.
They did that because there was no place to pull a boat out of the water between here and Seattle.
The structure was finished a year after the attack, but it never got to play a heroic role. The war had become an air battle, and Dickrell says the railway was only equipped to repair small boats, which were already struggling to navigate the region's rough waters.
You don't operate with small boats in the Aleutians. They tried to bring up YP boats or Yippie boats. And so they would try to use those for inshore patrolling and to do, you know, the close to shore work. And they just got so kicked around by the weather that they couldn't really use them.
Meanwhile, the war moved west to Attu and Kiska, where U.S. forces fought the Japanese invasion. The Marine Railway wasn't used much, but it lived on, even after the war ended in American victory. Dickrell says the space was actually used into the early 2000s, when welders used the train tracks to haul out crab boats. Like all of the surviving World War II buildings on the island, he says that longevity comes down to good old-fashioned construction. No power tools, everything cut and pounded by hand.
They were designed to last 5 years for the war, but they did such high-quality construction methods and used such high-quality materials that here's a building that's lasted 75 years. That's pretty cool.
Dickrell says it was a kind of comfort, too, once the railway was condemned.
Can take some solace in a building that was supposed to last five, lasted 75. It's like the Russian Orthodox cross, you know, you don't put the person's name on it so that when people stop remembering who it was, you let it fall to disrepair, and that's fine.
With the demolition now done, Pacific Stevedoring is deciding how to use the railway space for present day. Joe Sacramento says it might become storage or maybe employee housing. Either way, it's hardly the end of World War II's legacy in Unalaska. Just across the property, Sacramento's crew is renovating another war-era building that's held up a bit better. And they've just discovered a memento from 75 years ago, hiding behind mold and dusty drywall.
We just wanted to start fresh, so we gutted the whole inside. One of my guys came to me and said he found some writings on the wall, so we went over and seen, and it was two U.S. Navy Seabees had signed it and dated it 7/29/42.
Written with a deep blue grease pencil, the two names stand out against the wood.
Carl Oberliner, that's one of them. And then
WB.
That one I didn't look up. Morphew or I'm not sure, but this.
While Sacramento works on deciphering the second signature, he's already begun reaching out to the family of Carl Oberliner. The Navy man died in 2014, but Sacramento says he hopes to send Oberliner's signature to his daughters. That way, this piece of history can live on. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
In February of last year, Governor Walker signed an administrative order to help jumpstart mariculture, or sea farming, in the state. One Juneau couple is whipping up a recipe to make local kelp an enticing business and snack. They're one of a growing number of startups that see Alaska seaweed as a marketable food. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more on how the state is responding to the new industry.
There's an aquatic plant that's become a big part of Matt Kern and Leah Heifetz's relationship.
It's basically all we talk about every day of the week, every night of the week, every weekend.
Matt and Leah are dedicating so much of their time to seaweed because they've been laying the groundwork for a new business.
Kelp salsa. It's made from predominantly bull kelp that we harvest from around Juneau.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game doesn't have a formalized process for collecting wild kelp for commercial use, at least not yet, so the couple forages under an experimental permit. They say a lot of work and late nights goes into whipping up a batch of salsa. Can I try some?
Yes.
Okay. Matt pops the lid off a small mason jar and opens a bag of corn chips.
Today we have a green salsa verde, and another flavor called Campfire that has roasted garlic and onions.
And lots of minced bull kelp. I scoop my chip into the Campfire flavor. It's tart from the seaweed and mildly spiced. It's going to be hard not to snack while I'm doing the interview, too.
Yeah, we can feel free.
Matt and Leah recently received a $40,000 Path to Prosperity grant, which is for Southeast entrepreneurs to help grow their business. Last year, they made about 2,000 jars of salsa, mostly cooked up in their home kitchen. But they want to eventually expand distribution beyond Juneau. Having access to enough forage seaweed for that expansion could be difficult. But a California-based startup might be able to help. The company is looking at the prospect of seaweed farming in Alaska. Right now, Blue Evolution grows the plant in Mexico for its own products.
They were really interested in doing domestic production.
That's Tamsin Peoples. She's employed by Blue Evolution and working on the science of seaweed farming at the University of Alaska Southeast. Her company takes the dried plant and turns it into pasta. She says coastal states like Maine are already kelp farming. But developing it here has its advantages.
Alaska has bountiful amounts of coastline, obviously. We also have clean water. As an Alaskan, I think it's a great opportunity for individuals who otherwise in the winter are kind of just laying low between commercial fishing or tourism.
But one thing Alaska doesn't have is easy access to kelp seed. The Department of Fish and Game says you can only farm with plants native to the region. And that's where people's research comes in. She's been working on propagating seed from local kelp spores.
In order for the industry to grow, we're going to have to get a number of other hatcheries online.
A new House bill could make it easier for more nonprofit hatcheries to receive state loans. And even though those wouldn't apply to a company like Blue Evolution, Peoples thinks it's a good thing. So far, she's successfully incubated varieties like sugar and ribbon kelp, and those plants are growing in the waters of Kodiak and Ketchikan. Blue Evolution will buy the seaweed back in the spring. And as their kelp salsa business grows, Matt Kern and Leah Heifetz say they're also interested.
We plan to be sourcing directly from farms in the future.
They say for them, it's not about building a seaweed snack empire.
Yeah. This wasn't a huge leap in our day-to-day lives, though, to go from doing it on our home scale, because this is kind of what we would be doing with our time anyways.
That means building their business sustainably, making thousands of jars of kelp salsa, and sharing it with friends. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
When you pick Click Give, you become a partner with a local nonprofit working to protect the things you love about Alaska. Whether it's the arts, our parks, or lending a hand to someone in crisis, with Pick Click Give, it's easy to find a nonprofit that shares your passion or provides programs in your neighborhood. When you apply for your PFD, say yes to sharing just $25 or more of your dividend. If you've already filed, add a donation at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by Pick Click Give.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.